You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Hey, do you know why Voyage AC's bedtime spray is so relaxing?
The essential oils? Mm-hmm. The chamomile? Mm-hmm. Maybe the Bulgarian rose?
Yes, all of that. But did you also know that the crystal lipidolite Melanie uses in the bedtime spray releases just a teeny bit of lithium?
Lithium? Wait, wasn't lithium called Mother's Little Helper back in the 50s?
Precisely, hun, because of its relaxing properties. But now you have all the benefits of that and all these other amazing organic, aromatic ingredients in Voyage AC's bedtime spray. Just one spritz and you're off to dreamland.
You mean I'm off to dreamland? Sometimes I drift off while you're still spritzing the pillows.
That's so true. You want to check out this bedtime spray and all of Voyage AC's beautiful candles, phenomenal fragrances, and gorgeous face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
Well, you can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That's 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is the ultimate luxury blend of travel, design, and scents. Each original fragrance, every candle is handmade, 100% natural vegetable blend, and created by Melanie personally.
Hi, I'm Peter Sage, and I am the only one in the room who is grateful to go to prison. When I let go of the need to prove anything, and let go of the good opinion of others, when I started becoming internally validated rather than externally validated, my whole life started to shift. And when I saw and felt, a bit like yourself, on a recovery journey, when you've gone there, you want to help other people because you've walked that path. Yeah, you want to tell them it's possible. You want to come from authenticity and say, listen, I know what it's like to be at the darkest depths. I've been there, but there's hope around the corner, and let me show you the light.
Imagine going to court on a civil matter and then finding yourself sentenced to prison. For contempt of court. Motivational speaker, TEDx speaker, and best-selling author Peter Sage thought he'd be back in time to finish his workday when he went to court in January of 2017. But instead, he was sent to Pentonville, the UK's most violent prison. So what would you do if you were wrongfully imprisoned and had to say goodbye to your fiancé, your life, and the money you just invested in a major business event? Would you fight for freedom using every resource at your disposal? Or would you become a secret agent of change and show others, too, how they could conquer adversity? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Peter Sage, thank you for coming. You are always in some exotic location when I talk to you, and today is no exception. I love that people travel. It's my favorite thing to do. But my question isn't about traveling. You were also, you know, the title of your episode is You're the Only One Who Was Grateful to Be Imprisoned. And I want to ask you, what was your first meal after you were released?
Oh, after I was released?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Great question. Yes, I was taken to a local pub, English pub, and I think I had steak pie and chips.
Steak pie
classic
and chips.
English pub meal.
Did you
as much as
it down?
You could get, I'm sure.
And a pint of Guinness.
Yeah.
there you go.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that does sound good.
That sounds really good. Were you like dreaming about that? Were you fantasizing about it?
It was certainly something that crossed my mind a few times. Yeah, while I was inside.
Yeah, especially because you went so unexpectedly, and we'll get into that later. You didn't like have time to prepare. But thank you for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I'm never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So today, like I said, we are talking to Peter Sage. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. Peter.
Yeah, this is crazy.
I know, right? Was sent to the most violent prison in the UK as the only non-criminal prisoner. Instead of playing the victim, he chose to identify as a secret agent of change. He went from mentoring frustrated billionaires to transforming the lives of his prison inmates. He wrote letters to his supporters documenting his entire experience, which later became an award-winning book, The Inside Track, which I have my copy right here. Let's see. Peter is a six-time TEDx speaker. Wow. Whose multiple number one best-selling books have sold over 150,000 copies in several languages. He shared the stage with high-profile people such as Sir Richard Branson, who just went into outer space, and former U.S. President Bill Clinton, and many others. So welcome, Peter. We're so excited to talk to you today.
Well, I'm super excited to be here, Laura. And yes, it's amazing to actually say,
yeah.
I'm Peter Sage, and I'm the only one in the room that was grateful to go to prison. It sounds surreal.
It is, right? It is. Thank you for just stating that at the top, because it's something that was difficult for me to absorb. I start out by asking everyone how they identify. How do you identify, Peter?
In terms of who I am?
And who you are. Some people use pronouns. Some people talk about race or gender or just their role in life.
I'm a divine and guided soul who acts as an open channel to God's wisdom, a powerful agent of positive change who was born to reveal the greatness in others.
Yes.
There you go.
I love it. And I love that they just rolled right off your tongue there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you were the only nonviolent criminal in the UK's most violent prison. January 2017, you were held in contempt of court for a civil matter, sentenced to 18 months, and you were sent to Pentonville, which is widely recognized as one of the most dangerous prisons in the UK. And in your book, The Inside Track, The Ultimate Guide to Conquering Adversity, you published 11 letters that you wrote and shared in real time with members of your coaching group. The first one is called The Adventure Begins. The last one is called The Final Stretch. So, you know, just briefly, I just want to talk a little bit about what your life looked like before you went in. I don't want to spend too much time there. But you said that you went from mentoring businessmen to transforming the lives of prisoners, right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
My background is kind of twofold. One has been entrepreneur for the last, you know, three decades. I've been unemployable since I left school. and essentially just a business guy, entrepreneur. That's how I predominantly identified. But I've always been into personal growth, personal development. And so it made sense at one point to combine the two and became a coach and a business coach and a coach for understanding human behavior. And as a result, I built a business around that. And at the time when I was founding Contempt, what happened was I was doing multiple 6 figures a month in revenue. I had 50 plus staff. I was top of my game. I was running some of the best seminars ranked in the world for my 3-day business school. And we were just about to really explode and scale. And it was an exciting time. It really was. And I had this pesky little civil action lawsuit that was kind of gnawing at me. And I literally turned around to my staff and said, hey, I've just got to pop into court next week and get rid of this BS that's been hanging around. And yeah, didn't expect the result that happened.
Wow. How common is it for someone to be sent to prison for contempt of court in the UK?
Exceptionally rare.
Exceptionally rare.
And if it is, it's normally for a night or maybe a week if they really upset the judge.
Right.
Yeah, it's contempt is normally if you disrespect the court from the public gallery and shout abuse or something like that. And this case was kind of engineered by a multi-billion dollar firm who should probably rename nameless as Hewlett Packard. And when it comes to when it comes to picking fights, don't pick a fight with a $140 billion company with a $100 million ruthless law firm behind it. They know how to play the game. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see it coming. I thought it'd get thrown out of court. I didn't give it any credence. I didn't understand exactly how the court system works. And I think many entrepreneurs will find out or already understand if they've walked that path, that litigation is a tool. Mm-hmm. It's got nothing to do with who's right or wrong. When it comes to business, litigation is a tool. It's a chess move on a chessboard. And they were very good players, and I got outmaneuvered, and they sold it to the judge, and I never came home.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible. And so then it's the same, because here in the U.S., you would be sent maybe for a night or two if you were held in contempt, but not to prison. I've not heard of that. If it's happened here, it's rare as well. You call yourself a secret agent of change. And in the book, here's what I was tripping off of. In your book, your demeanor, just like it is right now, is so remarkable, right? You're lighthearted, like almost feckless as you're walking in there. And you're so relaxed that as you're entering prison, people mistake you for an undercover officer or a copper, like you say.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Tell me about getting this sentence, which most people would be like completely in shock over, and then walking in there completely at ease or seemingly at ease.
Well, I think you touched on a key principle, Laura, earlier about identity. How do you identify yourself? And from my side, it's important that identity is such a factor because it's the governing force in human behavior. Mm. How do we identify ourselves? And so when we do that, what happens is we choose who we see ourselves as. You know, a vegetarian doesn't eat meat, not because they have different teeth. A vegetarian doesn't eat meat because they identify as a vegetarian. Mm. The reasons they choose can be personal. But I knew if I identified myself as a prisoner, then that would immediately put me into victim mode, into resentment mode, into helplessness mode, anger, or all of that stuff. And it was pointless because you can't change what has already happened. So instead, what I did was I chose to become a secret agent of change. And that identity empowered me because I knew I was there for a reason. Mm. You know, I've spent the last 25 years helping people. And I'm a great believer that you should be able to walk your talk. Now, if you're a health coach, expect a health challenge so you can demonstrate that you know what you're doing. If you're a relationship coach, expect a relationship challenge so you can demonstrate that what you teach works. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? So for me, I've spent 2.5 decades, you know, I worked alongside Tony Robbins for 15 years as an experienced trainer. You know, if I can't be able to walk into a place where most of the people are in a place where they need that level of support, if I'm shining my light, why not shine it in the darkest place? I mean, I saw it as a gift.
Mm, that's amazing. I love that idea that you're going to get challenged by the things that you put yourself into, like relationship coach will be challenged by relationships. It reminds me of that thing where people say, like, you ask for patience and you get into a traffic jam on your way somewhere. Like, you are immediately given not the tools to overcome it, but you're put in situations where you learn those tools.
Correct.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. and we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
So before you even get to your cell, as you're kind of entering this new system, you meet a man called Jamie. I was wondering if you could just tell me about him and your encounter with him. This is while you're still being processed, right?
Yeah, I'm in the waiting room. And again, I'm seeing things that I'd only ever seen on TV. I've got no way of trial by fire, kind of learning on the fly. But one thing that working with Tony did give me was something called high levels of sensory acuity. I'm registering everything that's going on. I'm taking as much data as I can. I'm watching body language. I'm the physical stuff. I'm watching voice tonality, breathing patterns, hierarchical dynamics around posturing and significance and ego and who's more the victim, who's the natural pecking order. And there was this kid called Jamie who was there, who was probably, I don't know, maybe late 20s, something like that, early 30s, and got a goatee, bald head, and very loud, very self-opinionated, clearly a career criminal. I think it was his fifth time or so he'd been inside. And he'd been transferred from another prison that day. He was already halfway through a sentence, so he was in the processing room as well with probably about a dozen or two others. And I thought this would be a good opportunity for me to get to work and go make a difference. And so being able to navigate that and being able to wait for an opportunity, and I was listening, and he was talking about his son and how the worst thing about prison is that he was missing his son and he was very resentful, that the food was terrible, which I can vouch for. And he always wanted to start his own deli because he could cook better. I saw an opening. He sort of took a pause of breath and says, hey, Mask, buddy, how old's your son? Well, it's a calm, non-threatening question that was directed about him. And he sort of paused, looked at me. He'd been says, oh, he's like 3.5. And I started just building a conversation around how proud his son would be about when his dad got out of prison and built that deli. Because what an example a parent could show to their kid that they could come out and turn adversity around. And his eyes lit up. He says, you really think I could do it? I says, the way you're talking about how passionate it is, and say, I'm sure the food would be a damn sight better than in here. And we started laughing. And then we just started chatting. And this is in front of 20 odd prisoners. They're all listening in as well. And I was being mindful of my language on how I could inspire other people by them listening in third party. And it was just, it was the first kind of intervention I'd done within an hour of being there.
There are so many things that are incredible about that encounter to me. But the first is that I'm just picturing myself, and, I haven't been in that situation, but I can only imagine that if I were in processing going into prison, I would be thinking about myself. And it sounds to me like you're walking in there thinking about everybody else and assessing them not just for threat level, but for how you can be of service, basically, or if there's an opportunity for you to be of service. Would you say that's correct?
100%. And it's not because I'm a capable fighter or I'm tough or anything like that. Far from it. Yeah, it's because I had a belief that said I was sent there to serve. I was there for a reason. And if I'm there for a reason, the universe is going to take care of me. Wow. If I'm being put forward, I'm not there to horse trade. I'm not there to position. I'm not looking to jockey anybody's position out of the social hierarchy in the jungle of prison.
Yeah.
I'm there to add value and ask for nothing in return. And I was almost like on a secret agent of change on a mission to help. And people started to sense that. And especially when the conversation after a couple of sentences, you know, usually got a little bit deeper than the average, you know, what was on frickin' TV that night in the cell, or, you know, some stupid soap opera or whatever it may be, or some resentful victimhood based mentality. People could tell that I was a little different. And again, you've got to be mindful. It's not a case of being complacent. I wasn't just the most nonviolent criminal. I was the only non-criminal, full stop.
Wow.
I'd never been charged or accused of a crime. I've never been, you know, I still don't have a criminal record. Yeah, I've never been found guilty. Yeah, it's not even the police knew that I was in prison. Yeah, this is a civil action. And so I was not segregated. Prison's not set up for civil prisoners. They didn't have any. Mm. So I'm just treated like a normal guy.
Yeah.
And processed with the rest of the gang. But I knew that I lived in a friendly universe. Just echoes Albert Einstein's famous question, said the most powerful question you can ask in your lifetime. Yeah, not on a Sunday, not when you're bored, not after you watch Netflix. In your lifetime, is do you live in a friendly or hostile universe? Because that's a binary equation. And each of those two paths are going to lead somewhere very different. And one of them is a tunnel with no cheese. Yeah, if you think you live in a hostile universe, then you are naturally going to be assessing things through threat, through fear, through self-preservation. You're going to be egocentric out of a need for survival.
Yes.
As opposed to ethnocentric out of a need to support, yeah, care, contribute. And again, I wasn't just out there trying to suck ass or anything like that. It was about being able to spot opportunities to add value where my skill set would have a certain place that could help. And I've got to be honest. I mean, I spent 15 years working with Tony around the world in events and seminars doing psychotherapeutic intervention with people that I think were a lot more crazier than the ones I met in prison.
I can totally see that. So here's something else that I love. You describe your first cell. This is the one you share with Ali as cozy. I just love that descriptor. In fact, you say your first impression, you say this, I'm quoting you now. I couldn't believe it. It was like they had given me my own meditation room, complete with bed and toilet. That's a quote from your book. Were you really that pleased to see your cell?
Oh, honestly, I was, because this was a fascinating adventure. I mean, I was looking, I'd never known what a prison inside looked like. The only reference I got was an episode I'd watched of Prison Break. And it was pretty similar, to be fair. And I remember walking, it's like, wow, it was almost like wonder. You know, it's like you're looking at this kaleidoscope of uniqueness that I'd never seen, only imagined in, like, you know, Vine. And I remember when they opened the door and Ali was behind me and I walked in, I stopped. He almost walked into me. That we're carrying our bedding, right? And I'm like, he bumps me and says, oh, wow, this is amazing. In fact, the term I used was epic. And I said, this is epic. He's gone, what? Right? He probably expected there was a door on the other side,
right,
we could escape from.
Right.
I know. I've gone, they've given us our own meditation room with a toilet. the guy thought I'd lost it, thought I was nuts.
Yeah.
And we were banged up together for 2 days before we were processed. So I went in on a Friday and nothing happens over the weekend. So we just literally had 48 hours, you know, inside the room without even, you know, 5 minutes outside. And by the end of it, he was just so grateful. He's like, wow, I came to prison clearly to meet you. And that was really heart touching. That showed me I was on the right track. It showed me that, you know, I wasn't this crazy fantasizing idiot that, you know, should have been prescribed some crazy pills. But I was there and I was starting to make a difference, even for the first person that I shared a cell with. And that was before I was unleashed and being able to go to work with some of the prisoners.
Yes.
So it was positive reinforcement for the fact why I was there. And again, you can't fight what has already happened. That's futile. That's a fool's errand. You can only come to a place of acceptance, free up the energy that you were putting into resisting and channel it into what's the next best move. And as you read in the first letter, I use the movie metaphor a lot. You know, we star in the movie of our life. Yeah, I know that because we're the only ones that are in every single scene of our own movie. And so I wrote to my students and said, hey, don't worry about me, guys. I'm just on location for 6 months filming the prison scene. That's all. I'll be back. And again, if you take Daniel Craig, if you am filming James Bond, there are going to be scenes on the beach with a Victoria's Secret model that he likes to film when he reads the script. They're going to be great. But there's also going to be scenes on location in the Arctic under the ice with frogmen and stuntmen where there's no five-star hotels. His job as a professional actor is to show up and act the best he can regardless, because that's what makes a great movie.
Right.
And you don't want a boring movie. What makes a great movie? Everything. You've got action and adventure and comedy and tragedy and romance and heartache and everything. If I'm lucky enough to get to the end of my movie and choose the final words out of my mouth in the final scene, I'd want it to be something like, wow, that was spectacular. Mm. Now that is a movie I would pay to see again.
Mm.
Not this boring ass middle of the road, vanilla kind of, you know, keep myself safe kind of stuff. That's not the movie I signed up for.
Right.
Let's go out and swing the bat. And yeah, I was filming the prison scene, just like Daniel Craig would be on location, away from his family, under the ice, freezing cold. But he's a professional actor.
That's awesome.
And if I'm a professional starring in the movie of my life, I need to act the best I can in every scene, not just be a diva and bitch about the fact that I'm not on the beach with a Victoria's Secret model in the Bahamas.
Right. Yet.
That scene will come.
That'll
I'm
be
sure.
This,
I happen to be
this afternoon,
in the Caribbean
right?
now. Who knows?
You are. Okay, so this is something else you write. From what I've seen, first-timers cycle through shock, denial, despondency, depression, despair, and anger. And so you kind of addressed this already, but you were also a first-timer. Did you experience any of these emotions? Did you?
No.
No. You said no.
No, I couldn't afford to.
You didn't. Wow.
And that's the reason. I got 25 years of training. I mean, again, it's like if you walk into a situation where there's a bar fight and you've got a Navy SEAL standing next to you, he's not afraid, right? This is standard stuff. They've had years of training for that kind of stuff. Mm. Now, I'm no Navy SEAL, right? I'm not even a circus SEAL, right? For me, yeah, the only thing I had going for me, I had a set of skills that allowed me to manage my inner game in a better way.
Mm.
And that inner game was really about staying positive in the face of adversity, being able to smile in the face of overwhelming odds against you, being able to look at this and not take, I didn't say not take it so seriously, because if you didn't take it seriously, you'd end up with a sharpened toothbrush sticking out of your chest.
Mm.
But understand that I was here and I was going to make the best of it, and no matter what happened. And were the times I got depressed, were the times I was upset, were the times I doubted myself? Yes, of course, I'm human. But where do you live and where do you visit? Yeah, if you live in the gym, you can visit McDonald's or Domino's once in a while. It's not going to do a lot.
Right.
But if you live in, you know, on the couch with Haagen-Dazs and Pringles, you can visit the gym once in a while. It ain't going to do a lot.
Right.
So I've spent a lot of my time, my life, living and training myself to live in a place where I can celebrate the negative. I can look at it as an adventure. Life's nonlinear. I gave up fighting reality a long time ago for one simple reason. The damn thing kept winning.
Mm.
Right? Mm. So now I let go of my need for control. I trust in something bigger than me. I know that if I live in a friendly universe, every river of life winds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no straight lines in nature. It doesn't work that. And I can honestly say that throughout the people I've worked with and coached and have taught this level of philosophy, yeah, if you've had something that's been traumatic, whether it's a divorce, whether it's a health issue, whether it's a business failure, almost overwhelmingly, 6 months to a year down the line, you look back and think, wow, thank goodness that happened. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this now.
Yes.
Now, if something happens once, it's an incident. Happens twice, it's a coincidence. If it happens more than twice, it's usually a pattern, and patterns are governed by laws. So if that is so consistent, then you know it's going to happen again. My question is, if you're faced with adversity and it seems like an overwhelming negative, you know, 6 months or a year from now, you're going to look over your shoulder and think, wow, thank goodness that happened. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this now. My question is, why wait 6 months to say it?
Mm.
Just because you can't see around the bend in the river doesn't mean to say you can't trust the current.
I'm still stuck on where do you live and where do you visit. I've never heard that. I think that's brilliant. And it explains so much for me about my own life. And then everything you just said is what I try to do, which is align myself with reality. And that actually brings me to the next part of your book that I wanted to talk to you about, the section that floored me, that I was reading upstairs in our bedroom and ran downstairs to the kitchen and hijacked Scotty and said, you have to listen to this right now because you're not going to believe this. It's acceptance versus resistance. That was the section I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Especially the gratitude and emotional transformation exercise. I ran downstairs and I'm like, this is incredible. You have to hear this. It is basically a gratitude list about being in prison. And can you tell me what that is? Like what happened, what it means, and what you learned from doing that exercise as you were sharing it with your with your students.
Yes. And one of the things to remember is that gratitude and fear cannot live in the same room. Mm. Yeah, they're not good bedfellows. And again, everything is a choice. Gandhi said that nobody can ever do anything to you emotionally without your permission. And therefore, for me, the choice was, what do I focus on? Mm-hmm. There's always something to be grateful for. I don't care who you are or where you're at. And the challenge is, most of us don't ask the right questions. Questions are the steering wheel of the mind. Mm. They direct focus. And most people are asking the wrong questions, which gives them the wrong focus, which triggers the wrong emotions, which then sends them down a story that they believe is reality. And so learning to ask better questions, such as, what is grateful about this that I have not noticed yet? What can I be grateful for that I haven't noticed yet? Mm. And for example, one of the prisoners I was with, Mark, who was a big lump. He was a violent guy. And, I spent 10 days plus with him, banged up, and he would be, throwing chairs at the wall and screaming at the guards and threatened to smash the TV in my face if I disagreed with his victim story and all the rest of it. But one of the times I got through to him was, he was upset because he'd been given 10 months for assault. And I said, what's the most you could have got? He says, 3 years. And I said, well, here's a great contrast frame to try to interpret. Just play with me. I'll play a game of imagination. You may find it helpful because we can't do anything here. And that chair is going to break before the door opens, I can promise you. Right? So I said, imagine that you'd got 3 years. Well, let's say you got 18 months, and the judges split it down the middle. It was a big possibility. And your lawyer went in and said, hey, to the judge, he's a good kid. It's first time, blah, blah, blah. And the judge says, something? Imagine this was 2 days after us. I'm going to cut his sentence to 10 months from 18. And imagine your lawyer had come into prison this morning with some great news. Say, hey, listen, your 18-month sentence is now 10 months. How would you be feeling right now? Same 10 months. And he kind of started, he processed. He says, yeah, I'd be feeling pretty good about it. Mm-hmm. I says, well, right now, choosing to feel pretty good is the one thing that they can't take away from you, right? They can't imprison your freedom of choice as to how you feel. And that made a big shift for him. And we started getting on a lot better, and we started doing some in-cell workouts. He was upset about his weight, and he was putting weight on. It was probably 230 pounds, something like that, about 6'3", 6'4". Yeah, big guy. But it was about finding out something you can be grateful for. How about being grateful for the fact the sentence wasn't longer rather than moaning about it wasn't shorter? Mm. Yeah, and I would have books sent in, and one of them was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, the classic. And I would say to people that read this book, and I challenge you not to cry with tears of gratitude that you're in Pentonville and not in Auschwitz. I took my students to Auschwitz. I taught them some energy exercises, and we went there because theory doesn't cover the price of admission to the higher levels of greatness. So we're in Poland for a seminar that I did, and I took my advanced students. I took them through some energy exercises on how to protect themselves, how to build almost what we call the human torus. And then I put them all on a coach and took them for a tour of Auschwitz, which if you read on TripAdvisor, is probably the most common feedback is that people leave there feeling like they've been punched in the stomach. I mean, the energy, some are speechless for a day.
Yeah,
when you get connected with it. And my students were able to walk amongst them and feel empathy and feel compassion, but not have it affect them to an extent where I was saying to them, on the coach on the way back, asking questions. I'm like, I want you to explain to me why and how somebody who would be friends living next door to somebody who was a Jew and they were a German, and you put an SS uniform on them and suddenly they become mortal enemies. What is the process that somebody goes through? Come, we're students of human behavior. Explain it to me. And they'd go through and look at it almost like from an observation, from a critical. What could we learn from this? How can we be empowered by that, not disempowered by just falling into a pit of despondency at the horrors that were attributed? Mm-hmm. And it was the same kind of thing. But sitting in Pentonville, I was so grateful that I had a bed to lie on. Mm. I was so grateful that I had the opportunity to go and give my gift to people that would never normally be able to see it. I've got a very limited skill set. I'm not a smart guy. I dropped out of school at 16. I couldn't spell MBA. I went trying to figure out my own way in the world. The very limited amount of skills that I have, I was in the one place where I could use them. And that's grateful. Mm. Other people's graduation events are different. Some people it's their friend dying in their arms. Some people it's a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. Some people it's losing the love of their life to their best friend. Whatever it may be, we tend to get the graduation events that do play to our skills more often than not. And to quote Mother Teresa, she said, I know God would never give me anything that I can't handle. I just sometimes wish he wouldn't trust me as much.
Well, that was beautiful. I have that passage open, and you said, you know, after canceling 3 meditation retreats I booked to attend over the last 2 years due to schedule commitments and time pressure, life finally allows me to meditate in a place for several hours a day. Mm. Number 12 on this list is I get to deeply relax and unplug with no calls, no email, no messages or push notifications, no battery life, no schedule, and none of the usual constraints to worry about. I mean, reading it, I'm anxious for you in the beginning, and I'm expecting this kind of pink cloud you're on to dissipate and your land in heart reality and see things as they are. Even though I had talked to you and I knew that wasn't what happened, just in the reading of it, I still expected that to happen. And then as you continue, like, you're buoyed in there. You're not just treading water. Like, you seem to really be effervescent, like really, truly grateful. And I understand that it's a choice that you're making. And it's not a choice that I don't know that everybody has access to. Certainly everybody can make a choice, but I don't know if everybody's able to do it. I know very few people who could do it the way that you did. Here's the next thing I wanted to kind of talk to you about was when you were sentenced, I think you told me this, it might be in the book as well, but you had spent about $50,000 in Facebook ads, like right before you came into prison, right? Before you went into court that day, rather. And then you were engaged. Your fiance was in the courtroom as well. Mm-hmm. So you had kind of all this really big outside life stuff going on at the moment that you were blindsided by this. Were there other losses for you? And do you still see those things as losses now?
There was a lot of moving parts. You know, I had a thriving business. We had, again, we just spent $50,000 on Facebook ads that month. We'd sold $50,000 of the tickets to my business school. So you kind of break even putting people in the room who would then maybe want some coaching on the back end. But of course, now you've got $50,000 of the people that want their money back that isn't there. You've got people that shouting about, you know, all over social about, you know, I must be a charlatan and accused of this $17 million, you know, inappropriate stuff with HP, which is all fabricated. And all got that. All of that got dropped when I came out, as I knew it would. It was all, you know, the initial accusations were foundless, which is why I kicked back about them, but it was the kicking back that got me the contempt. So yeah, it's interesting. But no, there was a lot of moving parts, but again, I had to process, I had to believe that it would come good. I couldn't afford to let myself start wallowing in my self-pity or questioning or doubting, and I had to pull myself up by my bootstraps at that point. And the early days were the hardest because, again, it's a lot of transition, a lot of change. Mm. And so that was the time when I really had to double down and say, you know, I need to trust this. I knew I had a thought in my head that what if I was being paid 6 figures a week to stay in prison, right? How would I look at it that way? Like the same as an NFL player, a footballer, yeah, premiership footballer. What if I was being paid those kind of wages to stay in prison? Most people would love that. Most people say, I'm in. I'll do 6 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what have you. Now, of course, I came out $250,000 in debt. With no credit rating, no business, you know, lost my wedding. I had no, couldn't open a bank account. I got excited at that, by the way. I thought, wow, I've never dug myself out of a hole that deep before. This will be fun. Now, that was my attitude coming out. But I knew at some point it had come good because I'd be able to inspire enough people with what I did that would believe in me. And even if it wasn't financially returned, it would be worth the trip. I wouldn't swap it for a heartbeat. Mm. As it turns out, you know, we've sold, you know, a lot of copies of the book, which is perfect for people right now because of the nature of how a lot of people are suffering in the current climate, global yes. climate. I couldn't have written a better tool set for people to adapt to being on furlough or, you know, lockdown or, you know, losing people or anything like that. It's the same skill set. Mm-hmm. Just because I used it to deal with prison and a business loss and, you know, everything being pulled underneath me. But it's the same skill set. And so I'm just grateful for how many people it's now helping that we didn't see coming with this global climate that have written to me, thousands of people, that says, wow, this book has helped me get through the toughest time that I thought I'd had.
That's incredible. It really is. It's the way you refocus something that looks one way and you're refocusing it so that it looks not just a way that you can tolerate, but that you could get excited about. You can get excited about digging yourself out of a hole that's never been that deep before. And, you know, honestly, Peter, if I hadn't talked to you before and read the book, I would be suspicious that this was genuine. But having had a conversation with you, talking to you now and reading this book, I understand that this is entirely authentic to who you are. And you can just feel it, you know, when you're talking. You just said something there that I just wanted to kind of circle back to. So you were held in contempt because you were laid back. What did you mean by that?
I kicked back. I was.
Oh, kicked back.
Yeah, I was there in the courtroom essentially to argue or to explain why their version of me breaching a freezing order was fallacy. And I was on legal aid because they'd froze my account. So I had a state-appointed attorney.
Right.
They had a Queen's Counsel, Silk, junior barrister, three solicitors, their own transcriber. They spent $250,000 just on the contempt application.
Damn.
Which I got lumbered with. And it was insane. But my ego really kicked back against it because I thought what they were doing was just out of order. It was playground bullying with the size of the bully being the size of the financial muscles you could flex. And I had an indigo nature. I talk about that in the book. I kicked back and the judge didn't see that as contrite. If I'd have been, hey, listen, if that's the way you've interpreted this, then I apologize. That's not the intent, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. There was no case to answer as far as I was concerned.
Yes.
It was just distortion of context to promote their version of content.
Got it.
But the judge basically saw a he said, she said argument with me slagging them off against the court and they slagging me off across the courtroom and then the other way around. Mm-hmm. So that was silly. That was I shouldn't have turned it into that. I should have known better.
Yeah. I mean, but you had no idea what was at stake. Had you known, you might
never,
have.
I never, a million years thought I'd go to be sent to prison. But I also saw this. I saw the genius in it. I mean, as I say, life, the universe, call it whatever you want, found the only way to be able to smuggle me into a violent prison where people would never normally get access to this kind of work without ever being accused of a crime, without ever being charged of a crime, and then smuggle me out afterwards without even having a criminal record. I mean, if that's not genius, I've got to tip my hat to the universe for that one. That's just smart. And I say, if I had have defended myself, I would not have gone to prison in a heartbeat. It's just the arguments were just totally, say, fallacy, and my barrister didn't open his mouth. But I also recognize the fact if I had have defended myself and walked away, I'd have probably ended up, I don't know, clipping somebody off a push bike on the way home and I'd have gone to prison that way. I don't know, something. The universe has got to get me in there somehow to go create what I did. And right now there are tens of thousands of prisons across the US where we just did 30,000 copies of Mud or Stars that a charity ordered for prisons in Nevada, in Texas, in Ohio. We've got copies of the book in libraries all over the world in different languages. It's been incredible to see the amount of lives that have been touched. I got an email today from somebody who wants to collaborate as head of corrections in another country, one of the prisons there. And just, again, I was a servant. I was able to go in and do, you know, humbly what I tried to do. Could I have done it better? Probably. You know, we're all trying to put one foot in front of the other best we can.
Mm.
Yeah, I just did the best I could with the resources I had. And you say, if you hadn't have thought it was real, if you look at the back of the book, that's why I included the letters.
Yes.
There's letters in the back of the book from the prisoners, from the guards, from the governors even, showing that what was created there. And that was nice. It was credibility. It was almost vanquishing the doubt that mm-hmm. other people had. Because I'm like, hey, don't listen to me. I could write anything. I could have been on Spice in there and crack or whatever. But, you know, yeah, write anything. But when you hear the guards and the governors and the teachers writing letters about what happened, then it gives it a little bit more credibility.
It absolutely does. And there are photocopies of some of the letters. And some of them are, you know, typed out, but some of them are handwritten. I actually plan to read one of them, or part of one of them, before we closed. I have two things more I want to talk to you about, because I know we're running short on time.
Sure.
The first one is, I just thought it was a fascinating story of you typing and copying your letters and getting them out while you were still there. Can you just quickly tell us what that was like?
The letters were, for the inside track, were typed. They were handwritten,
handwritten.
I'd post them out.
Okay.
They're all handwritten.
Wow.
Most of the book is completely handwritten because we don't have access to computers or anything.
Sure.
What I was able to use was the story that I wrote, Mud or Stars, which is what I won the award for.
Yes.
Which was what was able to help so many prisoners and I got to type that up in class when nobody was looking. We actually got locked in a classroom when a teacher didn't show up and a teacher had to go substitute and locked us in as protocol. Now, you never get left unattended in a high security prison.
No.
You just never. And so we got locked in the classroom. And while some of the prisoners are running through drawers looking for weapons or stuff they could trade or whatever, I've got a computer in a prison. I've got this story I'd actually written in the cell by hand, on this idea. And I just banged it out. I can speed type. I banged it out. I printed 50 copies. I shoved it under my jumper. And when the teacher came back, I kind of smuggled it out and then started putting it under doors over the next 3-4 days as this secret mailman, leaving it on notice boards and desks. And that's what started to create the movement.
Incredible.
And again, as you know, it's called Mud or Stars.
Yes.
After the old adage, two men sat behind prison bars, one saw mud, the other saw stars. And the key message is that your environment never defines you. It mm-hmm. simply gives you the opportunity to define yourself.
I love that. And I love Mud or Stars. And you were definitely stars, right? That's what you see. The last thing I want to talk about, this is a story that stopped me in my tracks too. Tell me about stopping a prisoner from committing suicide in under 10 minutes.
Yes, this was again another gift. I'd broken my foot through my own silly. I ran up one of the stairs on the landing to deliver a book to a prisoner that I'd had sent in. I was excited and I tripped. I rolled over. I felt the bone snap. Hmm. I was waiting for the didn't have an X-ray for 2 months, but I was waiting in the med line. Now I never get let out of the cell for meds. Yeah, a lot of the prisoners do because they're on antipsychotic medication, antidepressants, and all sorts of other weird stuff. I'm never in the med line. So for the first time after 4 months, I get opened up to go to get these painkillers or anti-inflammatories, whatever they were. And I'm standing in the line and I'm always scanning. I'm always looking for opportunities to add value. Mm. And so I saw this guy. He's depressed. Clearly, he's queuing up. And I need to build rapport. And I ask him, yeah, what's going on? He says, I'm here to get some stronger antidepressants because the ones I'm on now aren't working. I really want to kill myself. In fact, I think today's going to be the day.
Mm.
And a lot of people talk a good game, but this was different. I'm registering. I'm looking for signs of significance, signs of a scream for help, signs that, no, this was seemed to be real. So I went to work, and I've got 10 minutes to stop this guy killing himself permanently. You can change anybody's mind in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You can get anybody excited, enthusiastic, or cheer him up in the moment. But when he goes back to his cell, which was on a wing I didn't have access to, yeah, so I'd never see him again. When he thinks the same thoughts, when he goes through the same circumstances he can't change or faces them, how do you stop somebody then wanting to take their life? Because suicide was quite common. Say we had 2 suicides in 1 day in prison while I was there. 3 deaths in 1 week, I think.
Wow.
And I just went to work and I break it down in the book. I know we don't have time to go into the full intervention here, but essentially you can't change circumstances, especially circumstances you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
He's in prison. His wife is upset. His new baby daughter's about to be born. His wife's blaming him. It's the anniversary of his dad's death. It was his best friend. He's just in a dark place. So how do you link the emotions that he's trying to escape to the actions he wants to take?
Mm.
And how do you open a door? Because with suicide, it's the same thing. All suicides, genuine suicides, not the ones that are trying to get attention or a scream for help. Genuine suicides are basically the place of learned helplessness where it's the only way out of pain is to kill themselves.
Mm.
They turn left, there's pain, right, there's pain, forward pain, back pain. The only way is to kill myself. And so if you can provide a compelling future, suicides lack compelling future.
Mm.
That's it. If they have a doorway or a possibility of a compelling future, and that comes with meaning and linking this scenario, like I did with Jamie,
mm-hmm.
linking this scenario to showing his unborn daughter one of the best lessons she could learn in her life, which is how, yeah, we all make mistakes. We all could go to prison or do dumb things or make the wrong mistakes, but to come out of it stronger rather than to kill yourself and basically send the message that, yeah, his unborn daughter was so insignificant that her father didn't even want to stick around to see her. Because he was linking suicide to redemption, to apology, to say how sorry he was.
Yes.
You slam the door on that pretty quick and link it to the fact it's the most selfish thing he could do, and it probably destroy his daughter's future, who would grow up with the same level of insecurity because
mm-hmm.
her dad was never around because she clearly wasn't worth it.
Right.
Then all of a sudden you start opening a door for possibility. And there's a lot more to it. I break it down in the book, the language patterns, yes. the sentence, everything. But yeah, that was something that I've had a lot of feedback on from people coming to terms with their own parents' suicides and understanding it for the first time as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do break it down in the book. It's such a beautiful story. And it's not just... because it's not necessarily because you're able to engage him in this way, but just the emotional transformation of someone who sees the selfishness of that, but not just because it's selfish. I don't know if I'm saying it the right way, that this is an opportunity, like you said in the beginning, for change, that I can look at this mm-hmm. differently. And, you know, this is something that I don't want to speak about lightly at all. And I know that when we hear this interview, as people are hearing this interview, it's actually Suicide Awareness Month, Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And that's why I really wanted to end with this last bit about what you did there. Because so many people don't know what to say to someone who is struggling. So many people have... use the same platitudes, or they stay away because they're scared.
you know, they say the wrong things.
Yeah, they say the wrong things, or they can't handle it. And when people read this book, and they should read, you know, obviously all the way through, and they see that story, they will have tools that I have the tools now. You know, I feel like I am more equipped to be able to help someone in that situation because of it. So thank you so much just for being so candid in your book and writing about all these really vulnerable things, but from this place of humility that it feels like you could be really arrogant and proud of all this stuff, but you write about it from this really beautiful place of humility. It makes it so accessible. It really does.
Oh, thank you, Lloyd. I appreciate it. It's wonderful feedback.
Yeah. And then I just wanted to read, I had a page mark. Let me just find it. Now, this is in handwriting, so forgive me as I might stumble through it a little bit. This is one of the letters that was written on your behalf. And let's see, it's from Edgar, which is on page 272. He says, "My name is Edgar. I have spent 11 years in prison, and at times I felt down and institutionalized. I met Peter in the gym where he'd been organizing a rowing competition for the inmates. He has helped me in my rehabilitation by reminding me of my value and self-worth. I have also witnessed him
disarm
a potentially dangerous situation between two inmates and turn it around into a positive situation. Whenever I need a shoulder to lean on, Peter always has time for a chat. My experience in Peter has been..."
In prison.
Oh, sorry. Peter. "My experience in prison has been enriched because of him. I wish him all the best in the future and a great pleasure to have met him. Yours sincerely, Edgar."
And that was tough handwriting, by the way. So
it was, but I chose it anyway. I knew that I would stumble through it, but because I thought it really encapsulated the feeling that I got after reading your book, after talking to you. There are many, many more letters in there. Like I said, some of them are typed out, much easier to read, but I really wanted to read that one because it felt like it told a journey, the journey that you've just described to us, but from the other side. So the book is called The Insight Track, The Ultimate Guide to Conquering Adversity. And it's available everywhere, right, Peter?
I actually prepared a little gift for your viewers, Laura, if you don't mind.
Please. Whereby,
again, I'm trying to get this out to as many people as I can.
Okay.
And yeah, you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and pay $24.95. But I prepared there's a little site called getpetesbook.com/Laura.
Okay.
And if your readers or listeners or watchers go there, then I'm giving it away just for the cost of shipping. And I actually lose $2 every book that I send out, but I've got to, because it costs me about $12. I think I'm asking $10, and I'll print a copy for you and I'll send it to your door. Give me $10 towards the shipping and I'll stand for the rest, and you don't have to go to Barnes & Noble. And that's a thank you from me to try to get as many people a copy of this as possible, because it's making such a difference to so many, and that's why I'm here.
That is incredible and very in keeping with the man that I now know you to be.
Right.
So thank you, Peter. Tell me, where can people find you?
I'm easy to find. Again, petersage.com is my website. If you want to follow me on Instagram, I put a lot of value out there as much as I can, at petersage007.
Yes.
And there's a lot of stuff on YouTube. I obviously have some programs that range at different levels for people if they want to take it a little further, but I try as much as I can to put as much value for free and free content out of there, or say even giving the book away, to try to help as many people right now, because that's what's going to get us through this current situation globally is more people trying to become the best version of themselves, more people becoming the example, not the warning. And I think together we can all learn from the road that I travel as much as other people can learn from the roads that you individually travel. And if we can do that and make the world a little better place, then that's why I'm here.
Beautiful. Oh, wow. Thank you so much, Peter.
No, my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
Scott, it's been amazing. Thank you for giving me the platform to be able to share with your incredible tribe.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share, or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.